This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
Happy Monday. Welcome to the Annie Fry Show. Thank you for spending some of your afternoon with us today. Very glad that you are here. So it's been a crazy weekend. We got to hear from President Trump, albeit, what was it, an hour later so that he finally came onto the scene? Mm-hmm. I have to say, the melancholy nature of the weather outside, paired by it being a Sunday afternoon, that extra hour that I had to wait for him to show up made me real sleepy. I fell asleep during his speech. And I think it totaled about an hour and a half or so. I felt like it went longer than that.
Oh, yeah. It was like an hour and a half. It was super long.
So, you know, you listen to what he has to say. And I thought at first, my husband was watching it with me. We were watching the Cardinals, which was just glorious. And you're watching sunny Jupiter, Florida. You get to see Nolan Arenado get a couple of bets. Yeah, they weren't great. But you got to see him up at the plate. That was exciting. You just get to see baseball in Florida. That feels so good. And then they say, Donald Trump, I got my Fox News alert on my phone that says Trump will be taking the stage at 2:40. And lo and behold, an hour later, he was taking the stage to give a speech. I thought that the beginning of his speech was way more subdued than I expected it to be. He was on script. He was speaking about Joe Biden. You know, some of the things that he came out and he talked about immediately were kind of calling out some rumors that had been swirling around about things that he was going to do or what he was going to say. Specifically, he called out the idea that he was going to start a new party. That's something that that's one of those things that gets floated out into the world, gets talked about. Why? Because it divides Republicans. Of course, people are going to talk about how you could remove the Trump Republicans from the establishment Republicans. And the more you see people hitting on that and hitting on that and hitting on that, and you keep hearing it, the repetition that you see in the headlines. And then if you consider yourself a Republican voter or a non-Democrat voter, or right now you're like, I'm not really a Republican, I don't really love that, but I don't like socialism, so it looks like my options are limited here. You go, well, am I establishment or am I Trump? Are these the only options I have in front of myself? Then you feel like you can't find a home there either. So the more division that can be made, and the more it can be, yes, trumped up, the better it is for the people who don't identify with anything on the right side of the aisle. Donald Trump came out and said, no, I have no intentions whatsoever of doing that. And he called it fake news.
The brave Republicans in this room will be at the heart of the effort to oppose the radical Democrats, the fake news media, and their toxic cancel culture. Something new to our ears, cancel culture. And I want you to know that I'm going to continue to fight right by your side. We will do what we've done right from the beginning, which is to win. We're not starting new parties. You know, they kept saying, he's going to start a brand new party. We have the Republican Party. It's going to unite and be stronger than ever before. I am not starting a new party.
So there you have it. So, you know, that's something that I want to just say, as far as this show's concerned, we could put that to bed soundly at this point in time. There's no new party that Donald Trump is going to be out there starting. Mitch McConnell said before, last Thursday evening, going into Friday, he said, yeah, I'd absolutely support Donald Trump if he wins the nomination. So if you have Donald Trump up there on stage with his first opportunity in the most friendly territory that he could possibly be delivering a speech, so friendly that he was an hour late, if you have him standing up there and saying unequivocally, there's no new party coming here, and the drumbeat throughout the course of the weekend for CPAC folks was talking about party unity. And this is the exclamation point on the end of the weekend. And it all starts with Mitch McConnell saying he would support Donald Trump if he was the nominee. Good grief. I don't see that kind of unity on the other side of the aisle right now. I don't see Democrats who have power that they are now obligated to use. Of course, that's why you're given power. Of course, you know, you get elected to the majority in the House. You get elected to the majority sort of in the Senate, and you get the White House. If you have Democrat control, and you don't use it, you're going to get taken out because of it. Why give you power and authority if you're not going to implement it? That's a lot of pressure for a party whose Democratic left wing and Democratic moderate wing are very, very, very far apart, with great repercussions on both ends of those, deciding depending on which side this Democratic Party decides to go with. So all in all, my assessment of the Trump speech, and I'm not going to spend the whole day talking about the Trump speech because it was one speech. And you know, really, here's the thing. Where Donald Trump fits in the vernacular of politics today is essentially CPAC. It's what the folks at CPAC decide they're going to want to do with him. What Donald Trump does today has no bearing on what the Democrats are going to do in the House or the Senate. He has had his power taken away as far as affecting actual change. Now he has to shift into motivator. I think he did a pretty good job of doing that. And then I fell asleep and I woke up and he was talking about the stolen election. I was like, oh, there it is.
Yep.
Am I dreaming? Where am I at? What's happening here? Oh, yeah, that's right. He's just gone in too deep. And I didn't want to hear that, but I thought on the net it was good that it was tucked away to the back end of the speech. And, you know, the drumbeat that you were going to hear every single time that Donald Trump has the opportunity to speak, he's going to slip in a jab about how he actually won that election. Even if he actually didn't believe it, because he knows how much it gets under their skin.
But who knows? Who knows? I may even decide to beat them for a third time, okay?
He's the 1990s troll with the orange hair. That's what he is. That is Donald Trump embodied in a nostalgic toy for me. He says that not because it's going to actually change anything. He says that because now he knows, and probably a bit egotistically, he is going to put the mainstream media in its cycle that they feel so warm and fuzzy when they get in that cycle. They know what they're doing. They know how to do it. They're the experts. When you take Trump out of it, then what do they have to talk about? They're going to talk about Andrew Cuomo and, you know, put your hand in the hat and draw out the current controversy that he's involved in and pull that out and talk about it? Probably not. So he's giving them what they want, but at the same time, he's keeping, you know, the talking points front and center. I didn't want him to talk about it, but he did. And if he wouldn't have talked about it, I think my jaw would have fallen open. If it wouldn't have come out, I absolutely would have been shocked by that. When you listened to the message that he delivered, the overarching message, listen to this.
The task for our movement and our party is to stand up to this destructive agenda with confidence and with resolve. The future of the Republican Party is as a party that defends the social, economic, and cultural interests and values of working American families of every race, color, and creed. That's why the party is growing so rapidly and is becoming a different party. And it's becoming a party of love. You have to see outside the streets. I mean, there's such love. The flags.
The flags. The streets were lined with lots of people who were supporting him. I saw a lot of that on social media. And I always watch him. Sometimes they'll put him in loops. They'll speed up the video of, you know, driving through the parade, and you find out, you think it's like 3 hours of parade, and it's actually a 10-second loop that you just watch that 60 times or whatever. Don't get caught up in that. Check the timestamp on the video before you watch the whole thing so you can know what you're getting yourself into. But there were so many times where, you know, when he was on the campaign trail, they would show the streets just being lined as deep as the eye could see for miles of people who would show up to support him when he was coming to a specific city. And they're still doing that in Florida. The straw poll that came out of CPAC, which they do all the time. And again, it is March. That's news. Happy March to everybody. It is March of 2021. And Joe Biden is the president and is going to be for a while, for a few years here. There's so much that's going to change now. Don't get invested in who's the nominee going to be, who does it have to be. But 55% of the people at CPAC said Donald Trump should be it. And Ron DeSantis was the next one in. He was the next one up. And I got to say, part of me is like, will you leave Ron DeSantis in Florida just so we have a place to go if Kamala Harris wins again? Can we have like one commitment? Florida, if you look across the United States right now, Florida is a Republican stronghold right now, which is really saying something considering how much of it was the toss-up state 20 years ago. Texas is absorbing all of the people who couldn't stand their blue state policies. They're all going to Texas, and now they're making that kind of the toss-up state that Florida used to be. And I'm just like, we need one place, folks. We need a place. It would be nice if it was warm and sunny as well so that we can go to there if we need a place to run to. That used to be the whole country. That used to be America's freedom's last stand. Now it's Florida. How many people can they absorb? Maybe we do need to like expand Florida. And doesn't China like building land off the side of their coast? And so that they, who knows what China's doing? So all in all, I thought Trump did. I don't think Trump did himself any damage. I don't think he had anybody watch that who was on the fence about Trump. And I do believe that there are people who are on the fence about Trump, not about what he's done, but about what they want him to do in the future, the job or the role they want him to play in the future. I think that he has the opportunity to gain some of those people and to lose some of those people. And I don't think he did anything this weekend, unless I missed it during my 20-minute nap. Oh, the rain was just coming down outside.
Perfect timing.
I realized I need to fix the gutters. You ever have like a rain and then you're like, why is all that rain falling right outside of my sliding door? Know any good gutter people?
His speech sounded like he has been enjoying his time off, I must say. It sounds like, I think that he loved the spotlight. Of course he did. It's Donald Trump. But he just seemed a little bit more relaxed. Like he actually had some time to go do whatever the heck he wanted to do and step away from the phone, go golf a little bit, and like,
Or a lot of it.
He should do. Yeah, it just sounded like he was just in. He had just enjoyed being back in the spotlight for a little bit, but also enjoyed his time off.
You had talked about scheduling your Sunday. That's maybe a little bit of dramatization around making sure you could see a speech. Were you happy with it on the whole?
I thought it was very typical. I thought it was a very standard Trump speech. All in all, I got what I paid for. I think that it's everything that I thought he would say. No more or no less. So it was good. Yeah.
I thought, on the whole, it was good. As I said last week, I thought he had a lot more to lose than to gain. And I think so really him coming out and doing what he did, I thought was a win for him. Because if he would have come out and he would have started talking about Georgia and Pennsylvania and Arizona and Nevada and just naming names from the very top of people in his own party, that would have been such a disaster. And it's not outside of my realm of imagination to consider that being a possibility. He didn't do that. He put Joe Biden on blast, as he should. And Nancy Pelosi and the way that these Democrats are, what they're doing with their power. And when you lose an election, that's what happens. And he acknowledged that part, that this is what was occurring now, which means if he's focusing on the now and not yesterday, which eventually he got to, but of course he was going to, I think that shows that he's invested in making something better. He's got a super PAC going. He's talking about getting people in there that are going to, you know, continue that America First platform. He said many times, you know, this is not America First anymore. This is America Last. And he was giving examples. of how that takes place. I want to play for you real quick before we get to a break. Listen to Dr. Fauci here. He's talking about some guidelines.
They'll be coming out with that. But one of the things that I think is going to become clear, that if you have individuals, adults who are vaccinated, two people that are doubly vaccinated and are protected, that you can do things that we weren't talking about before. You could have dinner in a home without masks on. You could have friends who you know are doubly vaccinated and are protected together with you. So you could start doing things essentially in the home, in a setting where you're not out in the community where there are 70,000 new infections per day.
Right.
And you could start doing some of the things that you weren't able to do before.
Listen to all the freedom Dr. Fauci is about to permit you to enjoy. I know that you're hearing him saying you can start doing this, and you're like, start? When did I stop? We're going to talk with Dr. Scott Hardiman when we come back and get a nonpartisan update on the latest with COVID and coronavirus and masks and doubly vaccinated and quadruply masked or whatever it is today. We'll find out what the standards are and how we're looking on the vaccine front from Dr. Hardiman. Your questions can be commented on the Facebook Live, the Annie Fry Show Facebook Live, or the Annie Fry YouTube Live. Put them in there and we will ask Dr. Hardiman those questions before we wrap up this hour. Stick around. More Annie Fry Show in a minute.
So we were very simple, Mark. Seniors first. And that was against the CDC recommendations. The CDC initially, they didn't want to put seniors in front of the line at all. They wanted to do young workers. And actually, their initial guidelines would have had a 20-year-old grocery store clerk get a vaccine before a 74-year-old grandmother. And that did not make any sense in terms of where the risk is on this. So I was the first governor in the country to reject those guidelines. And I said, we are going to do our 65 and up community.
So there you have Governor Ron DeSantis of Florida talking about his handling and his reaction to the pandemic, especially with this, the rapid nature with which we've had access to vaccines. We have now the approval of a third, I think it's a third vaccine that is a single dose vaccine that is out. And, you know, the news keeps coming. And I always feel like there's a lot of good news coming. But then you get into the news media and the way they cover it, and it starts to jumble everything up in my mind. And it makes me feel like, you know, I absolutely never want to not take this serious enough. But I also have to ask the questions, you know, if I'm hearing Governor Ron DeSantis say something, I know that's coming from a political angle. If I hear Governor Cuomo or Governor Newsom or Governor Pritzker say something, I know that that's coming from a political angle. It's hard to find straight facts and real information on the realistic nature of what we're dealing with as a country. And that's why we have, I mean, Katie, we got to go back and look at the timestamp on the first time we had Dr. Hardiman on the air, because I think it's been almost a year. Dr. Hardiman joins us every Monday, and he's here with us right now to give us that nonpartisan look at what we're dealing with. Doctor, great to have you back on the show. Thank you, as always, for being here.
Oh, thank you so much, and happy Monday to you guys. Good to be back.
The first question I want to ask you is when you are in, you know, you're in the medical realm and you know these things scientifically in ways that the vast majority of the American public, global public, really doesn't understand what's going on. Do you, I'm not asking you where you come down on what we hear in the media, like which side you come down on, but specifically, do you ever get frustrated with what you know medically versus how you see it being communicated to the American people?
Without a doubt. I think there's the fear and paranoia that's, you know, you can always look at things in two ways, and it depends on the color of glasses you have on, but the fear and paranoia that gets pushed out, it really has created in folks that are educated, but just may not live in this world every single day, to be able to really sort through what's noise and what's real, and then how to kind of put that in perspective as well. And I think we're starting to see a little bit of that. We've seen it on multiple levels, of course, but the most recent one now is related to the newest vaccine that's been approved. And we're starting to actually see people have arguments about, you know, the efficacy of this vaccine versus that vaccine and these subtle differences between the two, as if in the grand scheme of things, any of that really, you know, makes a big difference. And so it is frustrating, and it's challenging when you're talking with people too, who you can clearly tell very quickly or fall on the very, very fearful, worried, almost paranoia side of this, to be able to kind of walk them through and educate them of how they should maybe look at this a little bit differently, and also try and find the good news in all of the bad that's out there, because it's easy, right? I mean, things are looking much better at this point, and whether that means we're approaching the end of this or not, it's difficult to say, but certainly you can't ignore the fact that things are a lot better right now.
Dr. Scott Hardiman, you're a physician at Gateway ENT and urgent specialist. How do you, as a physician, factor in something like the mental toll that these things play and the psychology that goes into this, kind of the same thing that Annie was saying? Or is that even possible? Do you have to kind of separate that out from the medical side of it?
Well, it's huge. I think, and interestingly enough, now more than ever, we're seeing more and more studies pop up that look at the impact that this has on folks from an anxiety perspective and their mental toll as well. Not just kids. I mean, the toll that this has placed on the teenage population and young adults and even into adulthood, it's incalculable on some levels to be able to really see that. But certainly the perception, the pulse of many people is that the anxiety level is very high right now, that the stress level is high. And that's not even really looking at just the impact of what we're doing to kids with the school situation, with some schools not being open, social interaction and the masking, et cetera, what that's done to make them fearful of being around other people and interacting as well. So there's going to be far-reaching implications of that. I think the best thing we can do with our kids is just kind of rally around them and try and help them understand that this is something that can be managed and that it's looking better and that the parents will keep them safe and that, you know, they're going to do well if they were ever to get sick with this also. And hopefully that will translate once some of these mandates lift and we get to socially interact a bit more, masks come off. Hopefully that will translate into kind of return to play where kids can, you know, go back to being kids.
I'm so glad that you brought up our school children, because, you know, I've watched my husband as a public school teacher last year have to adapt, you know, with almost, was it a day's notice? It was like a day's notice. You're going to now be teaching online. That's what you're going to be doing. And, you know, my husband is in his 30s, so he's much more used to technology in a way that would allow him to implement that. But for some teachers who maybe are less acclimated to technology, that was an incredibly difficult thing, an unfair thing to ask, but everybody did what they had to do. And anytime we're talking about kids, you make one mistake, if one kid perishes because we made this decision, you know, there's definitely the argument to be made that that's absolutely one too many. But we have so many children who have been in school. We have so many Catholic kids and private school kids and Lutheran school kids who have been in school this whole time. Is there any instance across the entire country where it was obviously the wrong decision for those kids to go back into school where they've shown an outbreak that's had catastrophic consequences?
No, I think you set that up perfectly in that, you know, kids, there are great examples across the country now of how schools have been able to do this. And you can't, you know, take away from obviously the isolated cases here and there and just the impact, of course, that has on local communities and families. Of course, if there is an adverse event or a child dies with this, but the reality is, I think, is that we've got great examples, not just in this country, but certainly in other countries where they've been able to successfully keep schools open, keep the kids socially interacting, and really, quite honestly, provide a better education for them in in-face learning like that, or face-to-face learning. So, no, I think that's why, you know, the CDC now has this roadmap out to get schools open. Probably was long overdue, to be quite honest, because it was 6 months after schools had really, many schools had opened, the parochial schools and private schools had opened. And so I think there's great examples of how it can be done safely. And I'll be honest, from the schools that I've interacted with that have been open, I mean, it's been stressful for them because they're really attempting to do the right thing. And to some degree, probably even overly aggressive in keeping kids out of school if there's potential that they could be exposed or provide an exposure to the rest of the class, the teachers themselves. But by and large, it's been implemented, and the folks that have just said, we're going to do this, we're going to stay open, I mean, they really deserve a pat on the back because it's been a labor of love for sure to try and educate kids in person, and they've done a good job with it.
And just to follow up on that, is, you know, there have been kids who have lost their lives due to COVID.
Yeah.
Do you know of instances where COVID was the only culprit in that? Or, because to me, it looks like the stories, because I've got, you know, three school-aged children. I see those stories, and that, as a parent, nothing worse than considering that, you know, for your own family. But it seems as though they're always extenuating circumstances that paired with COVID were worst case scenario where the accommodations need to be made for those families. Are there any just COVID related childhood incidents that I'm not knowing about?
Well, it's difficult to know with 100% degree of certainty because when these stories do surface like that, fortunately, they're incredibly rare and isolated. And, you know, you got to get past the headlines, which will make it seem as if it was purely a COVID-related issue. But if you dig a little deeper, it's rare that you get all the medical history or information, but there's usually more to the story. You know, statistically, and it seems terrible to even reduce these discussions down to statistics like that, but when you look at the benchmark age ranges from 18 to 34 and say that's sort of your zero mark, you know, the higher, the older you get, the mortality risk goes up, and below that, the less the risk is. So statistically, mortality in children is almost zero. It's not zero, but it's almost zero. But we don't, there's no possible path for us to live in a world with zero risk of all things. I mean, influenza in general is far more devastating and unfortunately kills more kids than this particular virus does every single year. And so when you put that in perspective and realize that for children, it is largely not something they have to be concerned with being overly sick with and certainly being fatal to them in comparison to other respiratory illnesses that are out there. And then I think the one step further beyond that is just what that potentially, kids that get this, do they potentially bring that into the home or do they expose teachers, et cetera? And there have been well-documented cases that by and large, the transmission in school environments is really not between kids to their teachers, but in fact, the other direction. And kids at most of the schools that I'm aware of, the transmission has largely been outside of school. So, you know, it's something I think that we've got such great examples now of how this can be done. And just knowing that all you can do is mitigate the risk as much as possible. But, you know, with things trending in the direction we are, I'm really hopeful that schools move in the direction of getting kids back face-to-face learning.
So we're seeing a lot of good news with the cases, the new number of new cases happening every day. That's dropped to almost October levels, which was a low point, or quite not quite there, but close. I'm looking, though, at the national average of deaths per day in the United States. It's lower, and that it's moving in the right direction, but it has not been as steep of a drop as the number of new cases has dropped. So my question for you is there just a lag? Are we, you know, rumors that we're counting things differently now? What's going on between those two numbers?
Well, I think there is a lag, generally speaking. You know, this is a type of illness that generally it's not something where you get sick, get hospitalized, and quickly perish from it. It generally is a very long, protracted course. And so you'll tend to see the deaths drop after cases have dropped overall. But it does have kind of, you know, preference in that it tends to hit the older population more too. So I think to some degree, it depends on where the numbers of cases are. So, you know, in Missouri, the numbers are coming down quite nicely. I think a lot of cases are happening in that sort of 39 to 55 or 60 year old age range right now. So it would stand to reason that as you inch forward going in the next week or two, that we'll start to see the mortality come down with that because that age group of population has a tendency to do better overall. So I don't know necessarily that it's really a counting issue. I think there's been a lot of question marks about that. And to be honest, the dust will clear from this eventually, and it'll probably become clearer if things were counted incorrectly. I don't really think that there was an intention to do that even early on. I think this has just been quite a learning curve. And from a public health perspective, you know, in my career, will probably be the most amazing thing to have witnessed to actually take place. So I'm hopeful that what you said second there is that people start to see the cases that mortality start to really drop off over the course of the next coming weeks or so here. And it is down significantly from where things were, which is great. But, you know, obviously one is too many, unfortunately.
Yeah, with the rapid speed with which we've had success in this terrible time, a lot of grace is good to have here. It's just so hard to find it when all the politics get swirled into the mix.
Mm-hmm.
We're speaking with Dr. Scott Hardiman. He's going to hold on the line. And when we come back, we're taking your questions for the doctor about coronavirus, about masking, about vaccines. If you've got a question on your mind, come to the Annie Fry Show Facebook page where we are live and you can comment it there. You can also, if you don't want to do the Facebook thing, check out the Annie Fry YouTube channel. We are live there as well with the YouTube chat. Comment your question and we'll squeeze in as many as we can when we return with Dr. Scott Hardiman. Don't go away. We'll be right back. Well, welcome back to the Andy Fry Show. Happy Monday. It's a bright and shiny Monday out there. Hope you're enjoying the day. If you're out grabbing lunch and you're spending some time with us in the car, don't forget you can take us with you on your phone on radio.com app. You can find 97.1 FM Talk. Listen to all your favorite personalities throughout the course of the day right there on that station. You can rewind and you can check out the Andy Fry Show podcast there. But you can watch us right now live on our YouTube channel, the Andy Fry YouTube channel and the Andy Fry Show Facebook page. We are taking questions for Dr. Scott Hardiman, as we do each Monday, about coronavirus, about the vaccines, about all of the things that you're hearing. We try to sort through the muck and get you some real answers. Doctor, thanks for holding on with us. First question here comes from Vicky on Facebook. And let me find, oh, I just lost it here. Okay, here it is. Can Dr. Hardiman explain the difference between the two-shot and the one-shot vaccine? I've been researching it, but he always explains things so well. That's for Vicky.
Sure. So the two-shot vaccines are Moderna and Pfizer, and they're what are called mRNA vaccines. They use a sort of an adjuvant to get that genetic code into the cells that way. During their study, they looked at the reduction in mild to moderate cases and all the way up to severe to critical cases over the trial or study period of time, and essentially found that they're more efficacious if you give a second shot, or essentially kind of a booster in close order to the first shot. In reality, the first shot provides a very robust immune response. I think generally it's accepted that they're around 90 to 91% effective at reducing severe to critical illness in after the first vaccine dose, and then that bumps up in that 95% range with the second dose. The third vaccine, to be approved is the one that just came out, J&J, and that's also a genetic vaccine, but it uses a DNA code, and they use a viral vector called adenovirus to get the genetic code into the cell. And they did at one point look at two-shot series, but found that the results were very good with one shot. It's a little easier to store without having all the restrict requirements on refrigeration there. And so having one shot, I mean, that really is kind of a game changer, because it allows you to just get out there and get people to that robust immune response quicker, and can roll it out to other people, especially in rural areas or places where there may not be the capacity to have these refrigerated vaccine doses like that. So, you know, we kind of split hairs a little bit. One's 85% effective, one's 95% effective. We should remember that our gold standard for these things around 40 or 50% efficacy, like the influenza vaccine. And so there's really no significant difference in that. I think people are going to be faced with a decision of, do I get this vaccine or that vaccine? Right now, it's probably going to be whichever one's available to you. Right. And all these vaccines, when people get them, they cut down on getting the illness and transmission so much that we start to see that coupled with the cases, natural cases we have. It's just creating a dramatic reduction overall in cases.
Dr. Scott Hardiman on the phone with us, physician at Gateway ENT and urgent specialist, and our specialist on all things considering coronavirus. This question comes from Facebook, the Andy Fry Facebook page, from Christopher. He says, did we really cure the flu? How do we explain the incredible drop in flu cases this flu season versus last?
Yeah, I think there's some theories about that are out there too. We had talked a little bit last week about that, but I think at the end of the day, it has to do with the fact that there's, you know, less large groups and gatherings of people. Kids really aren't in school to a large degree. We've been masking and socially distancing. And then you take the fact that the influenza, while it's a contagious virus, it certainly doesn't appear to be as contagious as what the coronavirus is. And so it's created an environment where we've sort of pushed it aside. Is it cured? No. There are still cases of A and B out there. They're just nowhere near the numbers that they had been previous years. And that's cyclical like anything else. So, you know, they'll be making predictions about which influenza vaccine to roll out for the next year of respiratory season coming up here relatively soon based upon what happens in Asia. So the flu is always going to be back. It's one of those things that just tends to be endemic and commonly seen.
So here's a question from Mars on the Andy Fry YouTube channel. He said, I've had the vaccine. When will I have to get another round? He said he got Moderna. Did Moderna say 2 years? So based on the different vaccines that are out there, we're used to getting annual flu shots. What's the thought process on this one?
I don't know that they know yet, to tell you the truth. That's going to continue to be studied all the time. In theory, this is something that they can make modifications to based upon any variants or changes like you could with the flu vaccine every year. And so I think that depending on what happens with these variants, if they're new variants, if the vaccines are deemed to be not overly effective against the strains that are out there circulating at the time, there may be boosters or follow-up shots at that. But as far as when to get it again, it's difficult to know. Vaccines largely tend to produce a pretty profound immune response via antibody production. They don't necessarily prime the memory system quite as much, but in theory they do. And so I think over time, as we get further down the path, we'll know by tracking the study patients and their antibody levels if this is something that needs to be boosted again in, you know, 8 months, 12 months, 18 months, 2 years. It depends on what the antibody levels do in the study group.
Dr. Scott Hardiman, a question from the Antifry Facebook page from Jackie. What about the side effects that people are reporting, tremors, et cetera, and the efficacy with new strains?
Well, the side effects, so they're continuing, folks are getting the vaccine are continuing to have the study group looked at constantly. Also, people who are getting the vaccines can report any adverse events that are accumulated to a national database and continue to monitor that. The statistics on that is as we've ramped up the number of vaccines over 70 million now have been given is that it's generally not occurring outlying in any numbers with any other vaccines that are there. And so I think over time we'll get a better sense of that as well. But it seems as if the safety profiles are holding steady at this point. Against the variants, generally I would say these vaccines are being looked at very aggressively for that now. And it seems like there is significant activity against all the circulating variants that are out there, some more so than others, but carryover levels, the viruses are not completely mutating. And so I think that there's going to be a good level of immune response even to those variants in the near short term. But the more people that get towards that immune status or as we inch towards that quote-unquote herd immunity, if the variants have a hard time penetrating into the environment, there's less hosts it can go to because there's just not as much virus circulating in general. So the quicker we get to that point, the better it will be overall to stop those variants from having a significant impact.
Dr. Hardiman, I've heard that it's still possible to transmit COVID after vaccination. Can you still be a carrier and give it to someone else?
So the transmission was not directly looked at in the initial studies. They essentially looked at the severity of disease and the reduction in the illness in individuals that were vaccinated. It stands to reason scientifically that if you're cutting down on the severity of the illness, you're cutting down on viral load, you're cutting down on number of people getting it, that the transmission would be highly unlikely after you've had the vaccine. The folks that kind of argue the opposite direction, well, it wasn't studied, so we don't know. There are a couple of studies recently. I believe it was Moderna that did say that they looked at transmission and it was substantially less in the vaccinated group. And the same is really true for folks that have had the virus naturally, is that once you have good blocking antibody levels and a strong immune response to it, it's extremely unlikely that we would walk around harboring virus as sort of a symbiote or just living in our system that we could pass to others with any significant amount, because your body is going to be trying to neutralize that the second you're exposed to it. So I think that really lends itself to why there's strong arguments being made that as we can start to relax some of these masking requirements and social distancing things as we get more and more people, both who've had the virus and also who've had the vaccine. So in my opinion, transmission is extremely unlikely, either with having had the virus naturally or having had the vaccine.
Dr. Hardiman, this was a question I had asked to me personally this weekend, and it was from somebody who was able to get the first round of the vaccine, and they had heard us talking about this last week, and you had suggested, you know, the possibility, just kind of throwing it out there as a thought experiment, about if we would focus on getting more people the first round of the vaccine rather than making sure that everybody gets their second vaccine, you know, the double round of these. Can you talk a little bit about that, make sure I'm getting that right? Is the second installment of these vaccines, is it the same shot as the first? And how effective is just that first round of vaccine proving to be for people?
Right. I think, you know, when your goal is to get as many people vaccinated as quickly as possible to try and, you know, break those chains of transmission, it stands to reason that if you could spread out those doses, in theory, you'd vaccinate twice the number of people, right? So in places like England, they've looked at that and they found that extending the duration of time as much as 3 months between vaccine doses versus 2 to 3 weeks, which is what we're doing here, that it allowed them to have a supply catch up and able to have a great result with their vaccine. So the vaccine is very effective even after the first dose. It was studied obviously through the FDA in two doses, and so it's important to get to that point. But there are strong arguments to be made to stretch that interval of time out, not necessarily not give the second dose, but to stretch that interval out to be able to get more people vaccinated. Dr. Fauci seems to be unmoved by that. He seems to be fairly regimented and just, you know, stick with the routine. And hopefully he's right. And hopefully that the supply catches up with the demand and that won't be an issue. But yes, from a thought experiment standpoint, it stands to reason if you've got a vaccine that is, you know, roughly 90% effective with one shot after 2 to 3 weeks, you could stretch that interval of time out. Some even show it may be more effective if you stretch that time interval out, that you could vaccinate more people and get farther down the path quicker.
I think it's a really interesting perspective. It's why we love having you here so much. Dr. Hardiman, physician at Gateway ENT and urgent specialist, thanks so much for your time. It's always a highlight of the week. We appreciate you being here.
I appreciate it. Thanks so much. I appreciate you guys doing this too.
Of course. Absolutely. Thanks so much. UrgentSpecialist.com is the website. Check it out for your urgent care needs. I've been there too many times and think it's the best place you can go. If you can make it there, UrgentSpecialist.com. Check it out now before you need urgent care. Let's talk to Stephen Moore when we come back on this massive spending bill that's coming through. Don't go away.